CBS Eye on the World, the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor and Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College to comment on elections, past and future, throughout the Americas, where there is trouble now, trouble expected, permanently trouble. Elections are troubling moments, which is why they have in the past been very successful. You solve problems with the vote. We come first to Panama. The election is next year. But Panama couldn't be more critical to the success of the United States these last 100 years since the building of the Panama Canal. At the same time, Panama is a banking center and a legal center for Central America, for the Americas, for the Europeans. And to my knowledge, it is also the nexus of the anxiety about migration through the now infamous Darien Gap. Thousands, tens of thousands coming from all over the world towards the southern border of the U.S. But now, Professor, it started out as a dispute over a copper mine that is contributing more and more to the income of Panama as the Panama Canal struggles through the drought and a cutback in traffic. However, if I understand correctly, I get lost quickly when I try to summarize how a mine, copper mine, that they didn't know was there until they found it, and a contract with that copper mine leads to tens of thousands in the street in Panama City, and the question of next year's election is now in abeyance. How did the copper mine do all this by itself, just sitting there?
Well, John, first of all, important to recognize that although there's always been a lot of copper in Panama, up until about 5 years ago, there was almost no mining industry in Panama. And so many years ago, a small mining concession called Petaquilla was given in a deal that was seen as somewhat shady by a previous Panamanian president. But what happened then is a big Canadian firm came in as they detected that there might be something here. In 2013, they took over that concession. But then it came out that the way in which that concession was awarded was essentially unconstitutional. And so the Panamanian government had to wrestle with that because of the importance of the mine and the amount of copper. And so essentially, after the Panamanian courts uphold the unconstitutionality of the previous deal, they essentially tried to do a new contract. The problem was that frustration over the level of insider dealing and corruption and things like that in the terms that Canada's First Quantum got for the new contract led to away protests that were reinforced by frustrations over other things in Panama, rising prices after Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, etc. And so the issue of the copper mine really became an issue more broadly about the performance of the government and corruption and price subsidies and things like that. They got through that first round and the government came up with a new mining deal. The problem was that there was a lot of criticism that new mining deal was also maybe too corrupt and too in favor of First Quantum. And so the most recent protests had to do with that. The irony of this was that they didn't want to take the First Quantum deal away, and so they were going to pass a law that would have revoked First Quantum. But what they did is they said, okay, we'll let First Quantum have its deal, but we will revoke all future deals and we'll prevent any future mining from going forward. This now goes to the courts. It appears that the courts will actually rule that the First Quantum deal is essentially unconstitutional. But now that they've passed this law, what it means is that the government now can't go back and renegotiate a new deal. And so if the court rules it's unconstitutional in the context of these protests, then essentially what amounts to something that employs 40,000 people, 5% of the Panamanian economy, essentially goes away at a time which there's a lot of frustrations over Panama's economic performance and looking towards the May 2024 elections in which somebody that represents the previous era of prosperity, a populist by the name of Ricardo Martinelli may come into power and take Panama in unknown new directions.
To Honduras, an election that was successful for President Castro, the wife of a previous president, understood to be left of center, like the wave throughout the Americas. Instead, 10,000 people gathered in Tegucigalpa, the capital, according to Reuters eyewitness, in what a march that ended without incident, protesting President Castro and concerns, the quote here, "We are here in defense of democracy because we do not want a dictatorship in Honduras like those in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua." Well, that summarizes it, Evan. What went wrong for President Castro? She's been in office, I believe, less than a year.
Well, John, important to begin with recognizing that there's a lot of frustration with corruption and dirty dealings on all sides in Honduras, remembering that the previous president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has been criminally convicted for involvement in cocaine trafficking. The problem with the Xiomara Castro, the Libre government, which is essentially a populist leftist government, is that the establishment parties, the national party, and generally the forces on the right in Honduras are afraid that Castro, especially through her husband, previous president Mel Zelaya, will use their control to take the country in a kind of Venezuela style direction. And the way that traditionally has happened in Latin America is battles over control of institutions. And so the most recent protest in Tegucigalpa, it's about what appears to be a technicality, but essentially at the end of October, Congress went on recess. There's a stipulation in the Honduran Constitution that says you have to have a full vote of the Honduran Congress to name a new prosecutor, an attorney general. What they ended up doing is they had a special session of the Honduran Congress leveraging a committee that is dominated by the Libre Party to basically say, well, we'll do this now while Congress is out of session, and we'll put our own person in through this vote of the limited committee. So that maneuver while Congress was out of session, while technically constitutional, was seen as an attempt to kind of usurp the power of who you get to name as attorney general. So that was what got people out on the streets, largely motivated by the National Party and the conservatives. But it really goes back to this broader concern in Honduras of where Xiomara Castro and Libre are taking the country. There have been criticisms about the radicalism of people like a foreign minister Enrique Reina. There's been criticisms about the number of previous Mel Zelaya appointments. His brother Carlos is in Congress. Xiomara Castro's daughter, who goes by the name of La Picho, is also in Congress. Mel Zelaya's nephew is now the defense secretary. So there's a lot of kind of nepotism. There's a lot of kind of continuity of a left agenda here. And so, again, a lot of concern about where Honduras being run essentially is a leftist family business is going. And this battle over the attorney general appointment is just kind of one battle in that broader attempt to resist where the left might take Honduras.
It certainly gives us a list of villains, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. We go to another troubled election. This one completed Guatemala. Part of the Northern Triangle, part of the said to be the problem of migration at the southern border once upon a time. However, the president-elect Arevalo lost his party, declared illegal, illegitimate, did not register correctly. The transition continues underway. No startling headlines, Professor. However, the suggestion here is that Arevalo will either not take the presidency or will be constrained from the moment he steps into office. How do we regard the Guatemala quandary?
Well, John, this is a battle that's very much still in progress. By contrast to Honduras, in Guatemala, the conservative previous elites still control most of that nation's institutions. And from the election itself, where there is a use of those institutions to disqualify some of the more objectionable candidates, despite pressure from the U.S. and the European Union, then eventually that essentially backfired on the traditional families when the Guatemalans rallied around Arevalo. But once his Semilla party was able to win power, then there was an attempt to essentially invalidate the juridical standing of that party. So the catch is that even if Arevalo takes office on January, beginning of January, which will probably happen, if his party is invalidated as a party, that means the people who were elected, they would still get to take office. But without a party affiliation, they wouldn't be able to head key congressional committees and things like that. So it's essentially one legal maneuver more to essentially truncate his authority and his ability to get things done and essentially protect the status of the elites who have controlled Guatemala for many years.
And therefore, we go from Guatemala, not fixed, right, Professor? I mean, this could go either way, although I'm leaning towards the path of least resistance. Arevalo takes office and he doesn't have any authority in the legislature. We go now to Bolivia. Because the election is in 26, I believe. However, it It puts two men who used to be regarded as allies against each other, Arce, the present president, and Evo Morales, the once and future rascal of Bolivia. At the same time, there's a severe climate challenge for Bolivia, but also for the Amazon. We've mentioned the troubles in Argentina past. What we're looking at here is what Reuters characterized as climate alarm bell. Is that going to influence the election, or do the elections go forward on the basis of team play, ignoring the crop and ignoring the prospects of either flooding or drought?
Well, John, right now, certainly the climate is a factor in Bolivia's economic malaise, although Bolivia is in a better position than some. This year, it's expected to have about 2.2% growth, which is a lot less than the 4-5% that it had during the Evo Morales years. But it's not quite in crisis. Right now, actually, Bolivians are upset because the payment of essentially a Christmas time, a second salary known as the aguinaldo may not happen. In general, yes, the climate issue is very severe in the same way that it's impacted Peru and Ecuador and the Brazilian Amazon. So the El Nino effects, which may last into spring, for example, have created problems in terms of access to water for people in El Alto. It has taken the highest mountain lake in the region, Lake Titicaca, down to record low levels. It's down something like 29 inches this year. It has caused also devastating wildfires in the lowlands in the east of the country. So it certainly caused a lot of problems, and those problems threaten to create further problems for planting if rains do not come, and the agricultural economy. Soy exports from the lowlands are actually one of the major exports in Bolivia, in addition to gold and other mining products and now declining oil production. But at the end of the day, that economic malaise goes into the question of the current president, Luis Arce, who's seen as somewhat of a technocrat, versus the previous president, Evo Morales, who basically wants to run again and capture control of the key leftist populist party, the MAS, to do so. And so in many ways, everything that goes against Arce essentially allows Evo Morales to say, well, when I was in power, things were good, and so I should have the MAS honors. So the economic problems definitely do play into that battle for the future of the MAS and in the future direction of Bolivia.
Bolivia is landlocked. It has unknown relations with Peru, where the election was decided and then broken. With, to my knowledge, Pedro Castillo remains detained in Peru. The vice president, Boluarte, now the president, there's said to be inflation problems there, but there's more than that. There's the question of Peru's viability. And you mentioned to me that it is, going to host APEC next year? Is that correct, Professor?
That is correct, John. After APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum year passes from the United States, who is now hosting the Leader Summit in San Francisco, Peru and Dina Boluarte will be the host in 2024. But as you also point out, there are multiple connections with respect, first of all, to the population. So the eastern, southeast portion of Peru, which borders the western highlands of Bolivia. That was the area where, in Peru, that same essentially mobilized, largely indigenous, people, in many ways, seem connected to Evo Morales, were part also of the political, revolt against the ouster and imprisonment of a previous president of Peru, Pedro Castillo. Indeed, in a place called Juliaca, there were something like 16 people who were killed in those protests when the police, tried to come in. Indeed, showing that interdependence of peoples between the region and the political connection, the Peruvian government of Boluarte actually banned Evo Morales from Bolivia being able to enter Peru, believing that he was part of what was stirring up the problems. But as you also pointed out, the same patterns, the climate patterns and the other things that are affecting Bolivia are also that El Nino pattern are also affecting Peru in terms of lower crop production. But Peru is also being beset by other things, lower international copper prices, and also just because in Peru there have been a lot of protests during that Pedro Castillo and Dina Boluarte period. A lot of major companies have held off on making major new mining investments, and that has hurt also with Peruvian mining income as Peru itself tries to inch its way forward. And so in the case of Peru, there's an estimate that its growth this coming year may be as low as 0.9%, so less than 1%. And in part, that's impacted by mining. In part, it's a delay of construction and other things. And so in Peru, as Bolivia, those economic troubles, which go to El Nino, which go to mining and other things, are undercutting the stability of that fragile Dina Boluarte government.
Professor Avenelis, The New World Report, to Mexico. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.